Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is America's Alliances. With me to discuss whether America's global system of military alliances still serve U.S. interests is Meera Rapp-Hooper. Meera is the Stephen A. Schwarzman Senior Fellow for Asia Studies at CFR. She writes on U.S.-China relations and national security issues in Asia. She is also a Senior Fellow at Yale Law School's Paul Tsai China Center. Her new book, Shields of the Republic, The Triumph and Peril of America's Alliances, is being released today. Meera, thanks for joining me.
Great to be here with you, Jim.
I hope you're doing well, Meera, during these rather turbulent times.
I hope you're doing well there too, Jim.
I'm doing well. I want to congratulate you on the publication of The Shields of the Republic. I want to talk about what you argue in the book, but if we may, I'd like to start with the news that broke late last week, and that's the breaking story that President Trump has signed an executive order directing the U.S. military to cut the number of U.S. troops based in Germany by about 9,500, taking it from 34,500 down to about 25,000. That's a cut of about 25%. Could you tell us a little bit more, Meera, about what the president decided and why it's significant?
Absolutely, Jim. The president's decision is likely to be self-defeating for the United States, in my view. Let's start with the reason why U.S. troops are in Germany in the first place. In the early Cold War, the United States turned to a national security strategy that based itself on alliances and forward defense in our national security interests. That is to say, to protect American national security interests. Troops were never, nor are they now, there to protect Germany alone, but all of Europe, and with it, the United States. Because Germany was, for decades, the front lines of the Cold War, it still today hosts more than half of all U.S. troops that are based in Europe. But they are there for the defense of Europe and the defense of NATO, primarily against Russia and Vladimir Putin. In addition to noting the fact that American troops are there for the defense of Europe, I think it's also important to note with respect to this decision, it's highly unlikely to save the United States money.
Why is that, Meera?
Well, if the troops that are coming out of Germany remain in the U.S. military, we'll still have to pay the costs of their salaries, housing, and maintaining them. And it's been reported that they may be relocated to Poland, which would mean that we'd spend even more to build new facilities for them. It's also very unlikely that this move is going to get Germany to pay more for its defense spending, which may have been a motivation for the decision. Finally, I'd note that if this move compromises readiness, or if Vladimir Putin takes it as a green light to attempt some kind of a fait accompli on NATO's eastern flank, the United States may pay much higher costs in blood and treasure if it later ends up entering a conflict or a crisis that it might have deterred.
Let me just ask you another question about the president's decision. Is this in fact a done deal, or is there some evidence that this may be reversed or blocked either in the Pentagon or over on Capitol Hill?
Well, the decision has moved over to the Pentagon, supposedly for implementation at this stage. But the best case scenario for U.S. troops in Germany may be a historical parallel that we saw in the late 1970s. On Jimmy Carter's watch, the president sought to draw down troops from South Korea. And the way he was ultimately thwarted was through some collaboration between the Pentagon intelligence community and Capitol Hill, where Congress finally convinced the president that it needed to have a hand in any drawdown decision from the Korean Peninsula. So there are not a lot of checks that remain to this withdrawal process. There is a good chance this may move ahead. But if Congress decides to take a page out of this Carter-era playbook, we could see it trying to complicate this decision-making process, perhaps by trying to withhold appropriations for the costs related to the relocation decision.
Okay, and I should point out there's still U.S. troops in South Korea
some
40 years after President Carter tried to remove them. So let's talk about alliances and the rationale for being there. You've sort of hinted at it a little bit, but before we get into sort of the meat of your argument, first I want to get some clarity as to what we're talking about. When you talk about alliances, what specifically do you have in mind? Are we talking about sort of formal alliances where the United States has made a commitment in a treaty that has been consented to by the United States Senate, or are you using the term more loosely to indicate any country with which we have friendly relations?
I'm using the term quite quite discreetly, Jim, exactly as you did in the first part of your question. That is, cases in which the United States has extended a formal defensive treaty alliance to another country, where the content of that treaty suggests that the United States has a defensive interest in the defensive fate of that country. So by that definition, the United States has about 34 alliances around the globe today. They include its allies in NATO, and they also include its hub and spoke system of alliances in Asia. That is South Korea, Japan, the Philippines, and Australia. There's no question that the United States has a broader set of security commitments beyond just these discrete treaty commitments, but I think it's useful to study this group of formal allies because they were made a class unto themselves by Cold War policymakers.
Okay, so when we talk about this hub and spoke system in Asia, which is the predominant model, the United States has a bilateral agreement with Japan. It has a bilateral agreement with South Korea, but there's no agreement that includes all three of them, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so just want to make sure we sort of clear our terms. Now, I think it's safe to say, based on how you answered the first question, that you see value in American alliances. And where I'd like to start is with sort of the opposite point of view. We'll get to the argument for alliances in a moment. But what exactly is the argument against alliances?
The best argument against alliances today would probably be that they are an expensive, far-flung set of American commitments that may have been useful during the Cold War to deter and defend against the Soviet Union militarily, but that has outlasted the adversary they were designed for, and that don't seem to serve American interest all that well in the 21st century. It's certainly the opposite of what I argue in this book, but that's okay. The case that a lot of alliance antagonists make.
Okay, so one of the longstanding criticisms of alliances that they're entangling, indeed you go back to America's founding, Thomas Jefferson actually coined the phrase entangling alliances in his, I think, first inaugural address. Before that, President Washington, in his farewell address, had warned against having inveterate antipathies toward other countries. He was speaking particularly given the fact the United States was a very weak country that was unlikely to be able to carry the day against the much larger powers that threatened it. Is there evidence that America's shift to alliances after World War II proved the fears of critics that alliances would be entangling, that is, drawing the United States into wars that it otherwise would not have fought?
There's actually remarkably little evidence for that, Jim, which is one of the things I delve into in some detail. The United States has actually never been pulled into war by one of its treaty allies. It has on occasion joined allies in crises, but has generally done so when it saw itself as having an interest in joining them there. And that raises the question naturally why we haven't faced more entrapment, even though we've been led to believe that we would. The answer, as I see it, is generally smart alliance design. We've generally formed alliances with countries where we have strong shared interests in the first place and where we think we can minimize the risks that we see. This has meant that sometimes we've declined to form alliances where we saw too much hazard. Sometimes we've designed the terms of an alliance to minimize the risk of entanglement that you're talking about. And we've also maintained the prerogative to end alliances when we see fit. And if you'll permit me for a minute, I'd love to share with you what I think is one of the better examples of this fact, which is an alliance that the United States had with Taiwan between the years 1954 and 1978. After the Chinese Civil War and the Korean War, the United States decided it had an abiding interest in ensuring that the People's Republic of China did not overrun Taiwan. But it was concerned about extending an alliance to Taiwan's bellicose leader, Chiang Kai-shek, because he had designs on retaking the Chinese mainland and also had outstanding territorial disputes with China over some offshore islands. So this looked like a pretty classic entrapment risk from the American perspective. But rather than not form the alliance, what policymakers did was exchange diplomatic notes with Chiang to get his agreement that the treaty would not apply to his offensive use of force, as well as exclude the disputed offshore islands of Komoi and Matsu in the scope of the treaty. So this smart alliance design allowed them to minimize the risks up front, and it also left them wiggle room for when Taiwan did stumble into crisis. That is, in the two Taiwan Straits crises of 1954 and 1958, the United States was left to design its own response, even though it had an alliance with Taiwan. It had a lot of options for things it could do to support it, but not a lot of fixed obligations. ultimately, the United States ended up ending the treaty with Taiwan with its decision to recognize China. But in the meantime, it had preserved the cross-straits balance and ultimately was able to substitute the Taiwan Relations Act for this treaty and help to keep the cross-straits balance just as it intended to do so since 1954.
Okay, so having these formal military alliances has not entangled the United States in wars. And again, I'll note whether we're talking about the Korean War, the Vietnam War, Afghanistan, or Iraq, those were not the United States acting pursuant to alliance commitments or alliance obligations. What about the argument that alliances cost America too much, that if we didn't have alliances, if we didn't have to carry our free-riding allies, we could spend less on the military? Does that hold water?
Well, I think alliance cost issues are certainly to be taken seriously. And debates about burden sharing are really as old as the system itself. Historically, it has been true that the United States has spent more than its allies on defense. But knowing that the United States spends more doesn't actually tell us quite as much as we think it does. And let me break that down a bit. I'll start by noting that an alliance is a political agreement. It's not very costly on its own up front. It doesn't necessarily require troops or bases unless the United States decides it wants them there. And where the U.S. has decided that, that's because that's in the U.S. national interest. Moreover, throughout the Cold War, policymakers actually wanted American defense spending to be asymmetric because it gave them more leverage over their allies' defense spending decisions. And in some ways, this was only natural. The United States and its allies have fundamentally different defensive objectives. The United States spends on a global strategy, whereas its allies spend on their national defense and regional strategies at most. Nevertheless, I think it's reasonable to debate whether allies should be spending more. And I believe allies can contribute more and we can help them to do so without coercing them or destroying the system. But the central point to make here is that the direct comparisons we often hear between the United States and allied spending are not very informative. What we should be comparing is the cost of the preferred U.S. foreign policy with allies and the cost of an American foreign policy without them. And if you look at the ledger that way, I think the accounting is pretty clear.
And that accounting tells you what?
That accounting tells you that American foreign policy is far cheaper and more effective than it would be without allies. That certainly throughout the Cold War and since, the United States has had an incredibly ambitious global foreign policy that simply wouldn't have been possible if not for the political and other support of its treaty allies. And I think we can see this everywhere from in international institutions to the number of wars of choice that you mentioned, where American allies have joined us on the battlefield. Our entire global grand strategy has cost less and been easier to implement because we had allies on our side.
Let's actually delve down into that a little bit, because I was struck that, I mean, the title of the book is Shields of the Republic. The subtitle, though, is The Triumph and Peril of America's Alliances. How do we know that these alliances have been a triumph? I mean, how do you go about making the case that the alliances worked, particularly when, as you just noted, we have fought a number of wars since the end of World War II, and the alliances didn't seem to be a factor in that? Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
This is a question that very much motivates my research, Jim. And that is because when alliances are working, you don't actually see them at all. Alliance success is measured by the wars that don't happen and the crises that don't escalate. So it can be very difficult to tabulate this record and to know for sure what work they are doing. But the best we can do to come at this problem is to ask ourselves how the world would have looked different if we hadn't had alliances, but if much else remained the same.
So the counterfactual argument.
Exactly. And I work through a set of counterfactual arguments throughout the book in each chapter to try to investigate the role that alliances were playing. And the short answer of the record that I come up with is as follows. Without American alliances, it's likely that we would have seen a lot more war in the last several decades. Likely that the Cold War would not have remained cold. And although we shouldn't have expected conflict everywhere, we very likely might have seen it around Cold War hotspots, places like divided Germany, the Korean Peninsula, or in the Taiwan Straits. In addition, we probably would have seen more crises because alliances helped the United States and its allies to demonstrate their intentions abroad, and they wouldn't have been able to do that otherwise. We almost certainly would have seen more nuclear weapon states, and we very likely would not have helped to transform former wartime rivals like Japan and Germany into consolidated democracies, economic powerhouses, and regional leaders in their own right. And finally, as we were just discussing, the United States almost certainly would not have brought itself so much political goodwill by way of its security provision, which ultimately allowed it to maintain a very ambitious foreign policy that was less costly and more effective because it had allies on its side.
Well, let's flip it around and go to the second half of the subtitle, which is the perils of alliances. So you're not giving alliances sort of a total pass, an A plus, everything great. You're suggesting there's some dangers in alliances, a peril. What are they?
Well, Jim, I see the perils as manifold, but mostly they are structural. That is, the system survived the Cold War, outlasted the set of adversaries it was designed to defend and deter against, and it hasn't been renovated for the world that we see today. Let's take ourselves back for a minute to the 1990s, when the United States preserved its alliance system after the fall of the Soviet Union, noting, of course, that the fall of the Soviet Union was exactly the triumph that the alliance system was designed to bring about. But with no major adversary visible in Europe or Asia, these alliances were preserved without being focused primarily on Russia or on China. And unwittingly, this created some vulnerabilities that Moscow and Beijing would later exploit. Down the road, China and Russia crafted strategies that aimed to break America's alliances as they reestablished themselves in their regions. Military strategies that aimed to prevent the United States from being a reliable ally. In Russia's case, this means targeting NATO's eastern flank to reveal the extent to which the alliance is underprepared to defend the Baltics. And with respect to China, this means its use of so-called anti-access area denial approaches to target U.S. allies with missiles.
Can I just slow you down, Mira? What does that mean? Anti-access area denial, if you could just sort of spill it out for us.
Sure, absolutely. China's anti-access area denial approaches are basically the use of missiles to try to raise the risk to the United States of intervening in a conflict in the Western Pacific on its allies' behalf. So China deploys a huge number of short, medium, and intermediate range ballistic missiles, primarily to target Taiwan, but increasingly to target other parts of the region. And in so doing, can make it much more costly to the United States if it should decide to join a conflict on one of its allies' behalf. But I would also note that this isn't just about Russia and China's military strategies. In addition to these efforts to throw open U.S. security guarantees using high-end military strategies, both have also adopted coercive strategies that aim to advance their aims without ever triggering American alliances at all. So there I'm thinking about things like Russia's election interference in the United States and Europe, or China's island building campaign in the South China Sea, which is all to say that our rivals have updated their strategies in ways that implicitly acknowledge the power of American alliances, but the system itself has not yet moved to meet them.
Okay, so in this sort of new threat situation, you argue for reinvigorating, reinventing, renovating alliances. And I want to get to what that strategy means in a moment. But first, I want to ask a more fundamental question, which is just how appealing is it to countries right now to have the United States as an alliance partner? And I ask that question for two reasons. As we were just recounting that history, thinking about the Korean War, thinking about the Vietnam War, thinking about Afghanistan, thinking about Iraq, those are wars the United States fought not to fulfill alliance obligations. It fought it for a variety of reasons, but because we had an alliance system, our allies felt compelled to come along with them. And you think Vietnam, the Australians, the South Koreans lost soldiers in that war, and we seldom hear about it here in the United States, likewise in Afghanistan, likewise in NATO. The other argument I often hear, and you know, at least when I was allowed to travel, we could travel abroad, I frequently heard people say, and it wasn't just Europeans, I heard people talk about how they don't recognize the United States today, and they really doubt whether we share the same values. So as we talk about alliances, I take your point that the international scene has changed, but is the United States still appealing as an alliance partner?
Well, Jim, I think there's no question that we've done ourselves significant damage in the last few years and through, you know, all manner of crises and wars that you just enumerated. And it's worth acknowledging that the president of the United States himself is explicitly antagonistic towards alliances. This is why we're talking about the troop drawdown from Germany, as well as any number of bumps in the road that our allies have experienced in the last few years. And although U.S. presidents have worried about the value of alliances to the United States for a very long time, time, I do think the current president's views on alliances are different in kind. You know, he's engaged in direct and arbitrary coercion of our allies when it comes to their spending. He's adopted a very different view of national security that is at odds with longstanding U.S. strategy and has often embraced shared adversaries or denied shared threats. But part of the reason why this is also important is that it throws open a longstanding credibility question at the heart of U.S. alliances. That is, since the beginning of the Cold War, the United States has argued that it was willing to defend its allied countries as though they were its own soil. And this always strained belief. But if the president of the United States or if the United States itself is so distracted and so at disarray that it undermines these messages of assurance instead of reinforcing them, this sort of soft, tender credibility question becomes something of an open wound. And I don't think it is at all clear at this moment that countries around the world feel like they are in safe hands with the United States. And the question is whether we're going to be able to get this system back on safer footing going forward.
Well, I think this would be a particular challenge in Asia, where I would imagine many countries that would be potential alliance partners, and even countries that are our alliance partners, can worry that the United States policy may drag them into wars they wish to avoid or confrontations.
That's absolutely right. I think if we look to Asia, we see the confluence of a set of factors that are going to be really challenging for American alliance management going forward. That is the rise of China and the fact that China does present a number of challenges to allies in Asia, but also the fact that allies in Asia are preparing to live alongside that stronger China. That is to say that whether you're talking about Korea, Japan, Australia, or the Philippines, you have some interest in remaining close U.S. security partner, least so if you are Rodrigo Duterte of the Philippines. But you also have an economy that's deeply enmeshed with China's, and you understand China to be a resident great power in the region for decades to come. So the quandary that presents the United States there is not only how it can renovate its alliances for 21st century challenges, in particular things like China's island building campaign or responding to China's Belt and Road Initiative, but how it can do it in ways that also acknowledge that its allies have to live alongside that stronger China.
So the main takeaway from the Children's Republic, as I mentioned before, is your call for, quote, a new alliance strategy, end quote. Could you tell us, Mira, what does that actually mean in practice? What would a new alliance strategy look like? Is it about trading in existing allies for new ones? Is it doing something different with the allies we have, regrouping them? What is this new strategy?
Jim, I actually think we have exactly the allies we should want to have in this moment. But the central problem with our alliance system today is that it's overwhelmingly focused on military threats. And many of the challenges we are facing in the 21st century, as I'm sure we would all agree, sitting in the middle of a global crisis today, may not occur in the military domain at all. Because of their success, in part, the nature of conflict has changed around America's alliances, and now these pacts need to change to meet it. So I'm arguing that the United States must expand its alliances to non-military domains, in some cases to provide new forms of deterrence where they don't yet exist, and in some cases to prepare for challenges and threats that we can't deter. In the first category, I think of things like cyber attacks on critical infrastructure or state-backed election interference, forms of assaults on states that are so grave that they threaten countries' political independence, and that mean that the United States and its allies should consider including them in their Article 5 commitments.
Article 5 being?
Yep, the mutual defense commitments in their treaties that promise that each will treat an attack on each other as though it is one on themselves. But beyond these types of threats, alliances can also be used to prepare for a far broader range of challenges. We can think about them being useful everywhere from examining the national security implications of China's deployment of 5G technology to better global health preparedness and supply chain resiliency. And a benefit of expanding our alliances to non-military domains is that it would also give our allies a chance to do more. In cases like these, allies in Europe and Asia could increasingly work with one another because they share global concerns. They could specialize according to their comparative advantages, with Estonia, for example, taking the lead in cyberspace or Japan paving the way on infrastructure building. And with more of a non-military focus, allies can actually contribute more financially outside of their defense budgets. So what has been a set of burden-sharing standoffs for the last several years becomes an opportunity because broader alliances will be more balanced, giving these pacts a chance to survive and excel, hopefully, for decades more.
And so how much is it going to cost to do this? Obviously, a lot of the conversation in the United States about alliances is about cost. And I imagine that that argument is going to get more life in the months and years to come because we are spending vastly more as a government than we take in revenue. So there's going to be all kinds of budgetary pressures. Or is it fundamentally wrong to be thinking about this new alliance strategy in terms of dollars and cents?
Well, Jim, I think that as long as the United States believes that it still has an interest in holding a global balance of power in some form, that is ensuring that Europe and Asia stay open, which is fundamentally the purpose of this alliance system at the outset, although the terms of those debates may be changing, this actually wouldn't cost more than US foreign policy would otherwise, and it might even cost less. The reason for this is that the US and its allies would be cooperating on all manner of issues where the United States was likely to have a robust commitment of resources anyway. We would just be doing it alongside partners and doing it in much closer coordination. And part of what I'm calling for here is actually for allies to take on more of a lead in many of these non-military domains. So whereas the United States is going to have to maintain the lead on defending its allies from China militarily in the first island chain in the Western Pacific, countries like Japan and Australia can actually take on much more responsibility when it comes to things like responding to the Belt and Road Initiative or building partner capacity amongst coast guards in Southeast Asia. So as I see it, there is a natural confluence of interests and a commitment of resources that is already taking place, but that needs to be pulled inside our alliance system to make sure that all of us can secure the interests that we have in the years to come.
Mira, how would you respond to the criticism that reinvigorating our alliances or renovating them, if we succeeded in doing so, we made them more effective, we would actually just make the problem we're trying to solve worse, that it would be perceived as threatening by Russia, it would be perceived as threatening by China, that it would engage us in this sort of negative feedback loop, empowering the hardliners in Beijing, empowering the hardliners in Moscow, and that is become a self-fulfilling prophecy. I know you've been to talks, you've heard this argument made. So how do you respond to it?
It's an important argument, Jim, and it's one that we have to take seriously. But my best response is that we can look at the historical record for whether or not these types of dynamics have happened already. And my general view is that they haven't. And let me explain what I mean by that. Critics who argue that the United States' continuation and enlargement of NATO provoked Russia's invasion of Ukraine and Crimea in particular generally see the alliance as an antagonist to a resurgent Vladimir Putin. But in my own work, the historical record doesn't substantiate this. It suggests that the Russians were actually fairly resigned to NATO enlargement, at least into the early 2000s, and that if anything, the thing that really turned Russia against the United States was the economic shock that happened in the much earlier 1990s. Similarly, although scholars and strategists in China have long objected to the U.S. alliance system, they actually began those objections most vociferously in a period in the post-Cold War where America's alliances actually weren't directed towards China, and that is in the 1990s. So much as we do right to make sure that our national security policies aren't causing security spirals with rivals, we should also take seriously the fact that they are there for our defensive needs. And given that we've seen both Russia and China give us good reason to feel like we need allies in Europe and Asia, I think it's important for the United States to press ahead with this agenda.
Well, let's talk about pressing ahead with that agenda as we come to a close to our conversation. And I'd really like to ask you about the feasibility of what you propose, not in terms of how it would work overseas, but in terms of America's current domestic political context. I don't think I'm exaggerating to say that we're living through a moment of extraordinary domestic pain and strife by virtue of the coronavirus and the vast efforts undertaken by the government to try to prop up the economy. We built up a considerable addition to the national debt. Moreover, I think many Americans look around and say, yes, I know there are problems overseas, but there are a lot of problems here at home. And what we need to do is be focusing our energies, really sort of getting our own house in order, that we can't have the successful foreign policy that you want without addressing income inequality, racial inequality, racism, and a whole host of inequities that run through our society that I think sort of this current wave of crises has exposed. How do you respond to that argument, Mirror, which in essence says, yeah, maybe we can do it, but let us sort of do more important things first.
Well, it's a vitally important argument, Jim. I certainly agree that we are living through a stunningly important domestic moment. But my strong hope is that we're at a turning point both domestically and internationally, and that a new foreign policy agenda and alliances will be a part of that next chapter. I think there's no question that at home, our inability to keep our people safe from a global health crisis, the significant damage to our economy, and the failure to provide equal justice are testing our social compact. And we will be hard-pressed to be a security provider abroad if we cannot provide those things at home. But the international turbulence that we've seen these past months reminds us of the costs of unilateralism and of the fact that the United States is going to need a sustainable foreign policy strategy going forward if it is to maintain any kind of global leadership role. The title of my book, Shields of the Republic, is appropriated from Walter Lippmann, who used it as a subtitle in 1943.
You may want to tell people who Walter Lippmann is, since while he's famous to people like you and me, I'm not sure he's a household name.
Sure. Walter Lippmann was a well-known commentator and journalist. And in this particular book that I was referencing, he was writing about American foreign policy at the height of the Second World War. And he was arguing that the purpose of that foreign policy was to protect democracy at home. And also that foreign policy must be executed in a way that is solvent. That is, that keeps means appropriately matched to ends. And I think in light of the question you're asking, Jim, Lippmann's admonitions are as true as ever. That is, we are going to have a foreign policy that allows our democracy to stay safe as we address this critical set of issues that you've so clearly delineated. And we're going to have a way to do it that is in line with the means at our disposal. But nevertheless, China is going to keep rising. We're going to be facing down the reverberations of this pandemic for years to come. And if we face that world alone, I think it's simply going to outstrip our capacity. But we can remain relatively powerful if we have allies on our side. So my hope, of course, is that we're witnessing something of a historic turning point, both in American democracy and for our role abroad, and that that next chapter includes a role for remade alliances.
So you're suggesting that the United States is capable of doing more than one thing at a time?
I sure am, Jim, but you sound skeptical.
No, I'm not skeptical. I'm just glad that I could end this podcast on an optimistic note. I so seldom do.
Well, I think it's worth ending on an optimistic note, Jim, because although the challenges facing our alliance system are manifold and the challenges facing our republic are just as many, if not more, in this moment, the story that I'm telling here is ultimately a remarkably positive one of a system that was so successful in the aims it endeavored to accomplish that it buried its own record. So the call here is really to try to extend and salvage that success for many decades more. And needless to say, I hope the same will be true for our fair republic at home.
Okay, with that upbeat note, I'll close the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Meera Rapp Hooper. She is the Stephen A. Schwartzman Senior Fellow for Asia Studies here at the Council on Foreign Relations. She is the author of the terrific new book, Shields of the Republic, The Triumph and Peril of America's Alliances, became available today. Again, Meera, congratulations on the book. Very well done. And thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Jim. Great to talk to you.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of the Council on Foreign Relations, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe Collis pulled double duty as a recording engineer, as she has been doing since we've gone to remote recording. I also want to give a shout out to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.